then, welcome to minute 156 of season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today on this special Saturday episode of this season is Alan Sanders from the Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while. It's been a few months.
More than just a few months. It's been a very long time. The last time you were here was the second week. So, you know, now we're at the end of May. You were here in October. So what is it? Maybe it is 6 months, something like that.
Well, at this point, I feel like we're at the end of the movie.
What a surprise. What a surprise. We were at the start of the movie before, and now we're at the end of the movie. That's usually the way it works. You know, For those of you, you know, who don't watch movies, you know, usually you start a movie at a certain point and you get to a certain stage where you're actually at the end of the movie.
Well, you know, you could be a Quentin Tarantino kind of guy and you don't know where you are in the timeline on the movie.
That is true. That is true. I would agree with you on that one. I actually like the way that Quentin Tarantino does stuff nonlinear. There are a lot of other directors who don't do it as well as he does.
You know, he
likes to jump back and forth with things like that. That always reminds me. Have you ever seen True Romance?
I have not seen that.
Okay, so that is a movie that was written by Tarantino. He actually sold the rights to it in order to use the money in order to finance Reservoir Dogs.
Okay. Oh, really?
It was directed by Tony Scott. It's got a great cast. You know, Christian Slater and.
Patricia Arquette,
and there's tons of people in that one. It's
maybe
a great movie.
I have seen it. It's just been so long. Was Dennis Hopper in it?
Yes,
Dennis Hopper. Okay, I think I saw it, but I saw it probably in the Blockbuster video rental day, so probably 30 years ago.
Okay, makes sense. You know, it came out 32 years ago, so you know that would make sense. That works with the timeline. But the thing with that movie is that Tony Scott decided to film it in chronological order. You know that the movie is linear, but Tarantino originally wanted it to not be linear, and have like parts of the movie in flashback and stuff like that. So I recently saw. I don't know if this is a fan-made thing or not, but I saw a version of this recently, probably about 2-3 years ago. I saw, you know, the Tarantino version of it, you know, where it's cut differently. I mean, also there are some changes in what happens at the end and stuff like that. I'm not gonna give away spoilers since you don't remember the movie, but you should go back and see it. But I just think it was that was one of the few times where I actually said that. I don't prefer Tarantino's non-linear way, but to each his own. What can I do?
Right.
Yeah. So minute 156 begins with Ryan looking around at the carnage of everything that's going on and ends with Miller giving advice. So we ended things basically yesterday with Miller lying there after being shot, and you know we had Riven attending to him, and we saw Ryan still sitting crouched in a fetal position, and he finally gets up and starts walking around, and that's where this minute begins with him walking around looking at all the soldiers that are now running in to go help them. You know, they finally got their reinforcements to show up. And what's great is if you look, you can see in the back of Ryan, you can see where Ryben is taking care of Miller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never noticed it before. It's not, you know, when you're watching a movie like this in a regular way, not the way we're doing it, you don't necessarily look at everything. I mean, the focus is supposed to be Ryan looking around at everything that's going on. But here, you know, you see in the background, you see that Miller is being tended to, and I like that little effect, because it also tells us, it gives us more about the geography of what's going on and who's where, and stuff like that, which is very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we see a whole bunch of these reinforcements, you know, getting ready. There's a guy motioning to different directions and stuff like that. And then, you know, the shot changes and we see Ryben taking care of Miller, you know, putting some sort of piece of paper, cloth or something, or a bandage, you know, to try to deal with Miller's wound. And then we see Ryan actually walk up in the background, just looking around. You know, it makes you wonder the whole thing about what's going through Ryan's mind at this point, you know, now that he sees Miller has been shot. You know, obviously they pretty much know that most of the other guys didn't make it also, but you know, you think about the emotional toll on someone like Ryan at this point. And it's, you know, it gives the viewer a little time to reflect on it also.
One of the things that I think helps with this scene as well is, even though Captain Miller is down on the ground, the camera is still the lowest position in the shot. It's literally looking up at them from ground level. And it puts us, like, right there, not only in the intimacy of being right in the scene, but it gives us the sense of we're actually looking up at them.
Right. As if we're lying on the ground right next to them, possibly, you know, working on Miller with him. You know, that type of thing.
And, you know, anytime they have, you know, camera obviously means different things where you position it. But generally, this would be what you call like the hero shot. And you're looking up at the person, making them bigger, grander. So you're kind of putting that camera up. It also allows us to see kind of the scale of the background. But we are so close. We are literally within their inner circle. And it gets even more intimate here. Well, within as the scene evolves, when he eventually, which I think we get to tomorrow. I just love camera placement. And when Spielberg does this, we're suddenly right in the middle. I mean, we're right here.
I mean, that's the way it's been throughout the whole movie, that we're always right there with them. But, I mean, you understand more about camera movement than I do. You know, like what other types of shots are there?
Well, I mean, you depending on how you do things, you always have, and which ironically, when we come in, we've got kind of an establishing shot. We're seeing the scenery. We have a medium shot of him as we are pushing in, but this would be an extreme close-up, up-angle shot. Almost, not entirely, but almost Dutch angle. When you look, the buildings don't look straight in the frame. It almost looks like the buildings are kind of leaning, almost like the camera is just a little tilted. And generally, when you start talking about Dutch angle, which is when the camera's intentionally cockeyed and you notice it, it usually means something's weird's going on or something unexpected is happening or something sometimes otherworldly. But it makes you as a viewer realize something's not quite right because the world's not straight. It's a little tilted. And I think it's an indication that while Ryan may not know if Miller has been mortally wounded just yet because he's still alive, it makes us as the audience a little uneasy because we're not sure what's going to happen yet, especially the first time watching it. You know, we want to believe, and part of it is we love Tom Hanks, right? We're like, he's certainly not going to die, right? I mean, we thought he was going to die, but sorry?
I said, how could Tom Hanks die?
Right. But I mean, we kind of have that with lead actors a lot of times in movies. So you don't think about it, but it's a sensation you get if you're a student of film. That bit of a tilt makes you feel a little uneasy or something doesn't feel quite right.
Oh, well, okay. Very interesting. Yeah.
Watch that in any movie if they've got a Dutch angle where it's just a little tilted, usually because it's trying to convey something weird going on or something uneasy or something unknown.
Why is it called the Dutch angle? Do you know that?
I actually don't. Maybe it was done in a Dutch movie. I don't know. I don't even know why it's called that. I just know that's what it's called.
No, because like going Dutch means that everyone pays for themselves. So you know, like I was thinking, okay, maybe what they're saying here is that you know, it's an angle that everyone pays for
themselves. Oh, you'll love this. It actually, it's a mistaken pronunciation. It originated in German expressionist cinema as a Deutsch angle, but we just now call it Dutch.
That's really funny. Okay.
I literally just looked that up. Yeah, I just have always known that that's what they call it, as a Dutch angle, but I never asked why. See, I need you to be here to ask these questions.
It's a German angle.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. Which sort of makes sense if it started in expressionist film. You know, that's what you would expect. You know, from people who are, you know, from Germans who are trying to express themselves, you know, in the 20s and stuff like that.
Here's another little bit of trivia. If you're ever on a movie or set and they're going to be shooting something without sound, they say, we're going to shoot it MOS. And I've always wondered, why would you say MOS when it's without sound? And apparently it comes from another mistaken German pronunciation, because the director was yelling, mit out sound, mit out sound. And they go, oh, MOS. So that is from, as many sets as I've been on, if you hear somebody say, are we shooting this MOS? It means, do we need sound or not? If we're shooting it MOS, we do not need the sound to be recording. We're just getting the video.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. You see, sometimes things start a certain way and just, you know, I just read something recently, like the beginning of where AOK came from or something like that. You know, there was something that I think John Adams or John Quincy Adams used to always say, you know, and they just shortened it. And it was like some really crazy thing. I don't remember what it was. Right. So again, we see Ryben trying to help Miller, and then Ryan crouches down next to him also to try and help. And then it's like really funny because like Ryan is there and the camera moves up to show us Ryan's face instead of showing us Miller's face. So I guess if you call this the hero shot, so I guess it's changing, you know, to, mm-hmm. that Ryan is the hero here or whatever. But mm-hmm. as soon as Ryan crouches down, then Ryben gets up and starts screaming in the back, medic, medic, we got a medic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's not as if he's saying to Ryan, okay, Ryan, put pressure here. You know, continue holding, continue trying to stop this blood from flowing or something like that. He doesn't even do that. He just stands up and, you know, starts calling for some medic to come down and help him out. And then he just like runs off in order to, you know, it's good that he grabs his gun before he runs off though. You know. And then, you know, they get a shot looking up at the sky and we see the P-51s that are flying by. The ones that actually helped out in order to blow up that tank, you know, with a pistol shell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you know, they're trying to emphasize once again that you know, that where they got their help from. Now, do you know what do you know about a P-51?
The P-51 Mustang. I know, obviously, American warfighter, World War II, really, if I remember correctly, a pretty powerful engine, pretty fast plane, the P-51, the Mustang. But that's about it.
Okay. What year do you think it was first
used? Oh, it was late. It was late. I mean, toward the end of the war, like 43, 44.
Actually, they started using them in 1940.
Really?
Yes. Again, they had different versions. Yeah, different versions of it. No, the Mustang originally was they had the first flight in 1940, and the Brits started using it in 1942.
Okay.
And then they were eventually they had the P-51A and the P-51B and the C and the D. You know, the D was the one that came out in the mid 1944. They were used to escort bombing raids into Germany.
Okay.
And the Mustang pilots claimed to have destroyed nearly 5,000 enemy aircraft, 4,950. In dogfights over the course of the war. I mean, that's just amazing.
I remember there was a thing about the way it was designed. That style of fighter jet made it not only fast, but had a pretty, now I might be conflating things, but I think it had a pretty good range. And maybe that's why they would use it on the bombing runs as well, that it would be able to go on longer missions. I do know. I think it got its nickname from the Brits. I do know that because it was just the P-51, but it became known as the Mustang because of how fast it was, and you know, being the comparison to a horse. You know, as fast as a horse, obviously a lot faster, but you know, in the Brits' mind, this is the fastest plane they had seen at that time in for a fighter.
Right. And then because of the way that they flew and everything like that, during 1942, they had 26 operations that flew Mustangs, and their loss rate was only 2%.
Wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I would agree. I mean, the Tuskegees used it also. Again, it was known as a very good plane to use for all these dogfighting and stuff that they needed to use it for.
Until the jets became a little bit more affordable, they went and were used initially at the start of the Korean War.
Yes, they were used during Korean War also. Very good. And but already by Vietnam, they didn't use them anymore.
Oh, no, we had jets by then. You know, your F-4 Phantom was much more prevalent as a fighter jet of choice in Vietnam.
Correct. There were two P-51 pilots who received the Medal of Honor during World War II. One of them was James Howard. He was doing a bombing escort mission on January 11th, 1944, my birthday. 30 years before I was born, but still. he shot down three German planes and continued to defend the bombers, even when his guns went out of action and fuel supply became dangerously low. Wow. Okay, and then another one is William Shomo was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions over Luzon, Philippines. Wow, on January 11th, 1945. That's really
same
amazing.
Day, a year later.
Same day, one
That's
year apart.
That's wild.
That's right, and both in my birthday. You know.
You missed your calling. You were supposed to be a fighter pilot.
Maybe I was in another life. I don't know. He apparently shot down seven Japanese planes that day and was known as the ace in the day. And his plane was known as Snooks the Fifth. I have no idea why.
That's very strange. Me neither.
Strange name, but okay. we'll give it to them. Right. So again, we see the shot of the P-51 flying over two of them flying above. And first of all, it's a great shot because once again, going back to what you said earlier, it's showing us, our perspective of things. You know, we are there right next to Miller and Ryan. You know, and we see Ryan looking up, and so we're looking up with him. And then you got these planes just flying right by. And they basically glide by also. You know, the shot is done really well. And at this point, Ryan then says to Miller, "They're tank busters, sir. B-51s. And Miller has a great response. He goes, "Angels on our soldiers. Angels." And he says, "Angels on our shoulders." Mm-hmm. Soldiers. And Ryan is... It's funny. Ryan is enamored by the planes and isn't really paying much attention. He goes, "What's her?" Ryan then leans in a little closer to try to figure out what it is that Miller is trying to say. And we can see once again in the background Ryben completely out of whack. You know, like he doesn't know what he's supposed to do. He's looking back. He's looking forward. He's trying to figure out, you know, what am I supposed to do here? I'm trying to get a medic. No one's showing up. You see him let out like a really long breath while he's waiting and stuff like that.
What's funny about all of the meticulous detail and the fact that they recreated so much from the weapons to the sound, all the stuff we talked about at the very beginning of the movie, this is one of the most blatantly fake lines in the movie because P-51s were not tank busters. They could be used every now and then, but the P-47, which was much more armored and carried rockets, was used in that role. P-51s, as you mentioned, were more bomber escort. I remember watching a YouTube video. I don't know if you watch any of these. I love watching where they bring a real expert in their field to then watch a bunch of movies made about their field, and they rank and rate how realistic the scenes are.
I haven't seen any of those. I've seen a few of those, but
There was one I watched, and this was a while ago, probably more toward the start of this project, and maybe because it must have been listening to me, because all of a sudden, after we had talked about Saving Private Ryan at the beginning of the movie, all of a sudden my YouTube feed had all these videos on Saving Private Ryan. So I clicked on one, and the guy was saying that's the line that gets to him the most, because it's so easily fact-checked that the P-51s were not called tank busters. It was the P-47.
Okay, but this could just be a mistake that Ryan makes. You know, that's what it is. This is not necessarily a filmmaker mistake. This is a mistake that the character could make. I mean, again, he's an infantryman. You know, he's a paratrooper. He's what does he know about planes? You know, he could be wrong even that it's a P-51. He could say, hey, you know, that maybe they're P-47s. I don't know.
We could excuse it that way, but as an audience member, we assume that the writer of the movie isn't dropping this unless he calls out the fact that Ryan doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, he's talking to a guy dying, so like he doesn't really you can say whatever you want.
So anyway, there's no such thing as a perfect movie, but I do think with all of the meticulous attention to detail, that one stands out, only because, again, I watched the video with an expert on it, and then when you go look it up, you go, oh, yeah, I know, P-47s were the ones that you would use, the Thunderbolt. That was specifically for ground, because it was a lot heavier armored, and it carried rockets, where the Mustang was much more of the long-range bomber escort.
Okay, fair enough. Now, what's very funny is if you look on IMDb, so when it talks about the P-51s, it's in the goofs. It says, in the final battle scenes, the P-51s are supposed to be tank busters, but none of them have any rockets, bombs, or even bomb racks attached to their wings.
No, it's true. Not even armed. Well, they fired them already, I guess. We can use that excuse, right? Just, unfortunately, nothing to hold the rockets or the bombs.
Correct. And here's another one. P-51s at the end of the movie have black and white checkered pattern on the nose, showing them to be from the 78th Fighter Group. This group did not receive P-51s until the end of the 44.
So. I will tell you this. There is a nerd group out there for everything. And when it comes to military history and military, like knowing the badges, knowing that there will be people who are, if you make a World War II movie, realize there's going to be a subgroup of people out there who are going to try to find anything you got wrong.
That's right. That's right. All right. Here's another thing they have to say here about it. Private Ryan incorrectly regards the P-51 Mustang as a tank buster. P-51 Mustangs are not effective at attacking ground targets, as it is designed to counter enemy aircraft. Another aircraft referred to as the P-47 Thunderbolt should have been more accurately been referred to as a tank buster, as it's designed to destroy enemy vehicles, including hard-skinned German Panzers.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the goofs that people have mentioned, you know, about the P-51. And then we get to see Miller's shaking hand again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got his pistol on the side, and he reaches up and grabs Ryan and pulls him closer to him. And he starts whispering, he goes, James. And, you know, Ryan really wants to listen. And what does he say?
Earn What's the line? This.
Earn this. That's right. Which basically makes you see that even when he's dying, the character of Miller is always the teacher.
Well, you know, and you think
that most people, you know, at this point, when you know you're about to die, you're going to have something more profound to say than to tell someone earn this. You know, because what he's basically saying is make sure that what you do makes it that it was worthwhile for me to die.
And, you know, I go back. This is one of those movies I can feel that moment in the theater. We talked about it again at the beginning, things that just will always be stuck in your head, your first impression, your first reaction. And, you know, when we were on the beach watching things together at the very beginning of this season of yours, we were able to talk about all this. And this is one of those lines where in the movie theater, I'm still under the impression that he's not going to die.
Right.
And so when he said, earn this, it still didn't belie to me that these were his dying words until a few seconds later. It just seemed like
not his own words. He does say something else afterwards, but still, you know, it's close.
But I mean,
he's getting it.
But I remember because I didn't think he was going to die. So when you say earn this, I mean, here's a guy who's he's wounded. He's on the ground. Obviously, we just watched this entire battle ensue and it was all for him. So the line doesn't necessarily, in my mind, it didn't give away that he's about to die.
Right.
And maybe that's just my hope as an audience member. I just didn't want him to.
Again, it's you know, we could probably go through a list of movies, you know, where the main character should have died and didn't die, or vice versa. Movies where you're surprised that the main character did die and stuff like that. I mean, but this is, you know, they're bringing us to this point where, okay, you have this guy who's wounded. We don't know how wounded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is he going to die? Is he or isn't he? You know, that type of thing. You know, you talk about romantic comedies, you know, will they or won't they? But here, this is... Is he or isn't he? You know, is he about to gonna die, or is he gonna make it out a little bit? Make it out of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they don't really give us much of an indication here because, you know, it's not as if he's coughing up blood or anything like that. You know, there are ways of like when Wade died, you knew that he wasn't gonna live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way that he was, and you can actually say the same thing about Caparzo. You know, the two of them are just profusely bleeding. You hear there's blood under his jacket. That's it. Like, we don't know how much he's really bleeding. You know, and I guess the fact that Ryben stopped applying pressure, you know, either Ryben just decided there wasn't anything else that he can do, or, you know, it's more important to get a medic over here. I don't know.
Right.
Could be one of the two. But again, I as anyone who's already listened to, 155 episodes of this season, you know, and we'll continue to apparently earn this made an impression on me.
Yeah.
Using that, I mean, it makes an impression on anyone. It's, it's just a nice way to put it.
It, and obviously we'll get to it before the end of the week here, but it's one of those lines that seems so innocuous when it's being said, and yet in retrospect, echoes through Ryan's entire life.
Correct. Well, it doesn't because I'm sure we'll talk about this later in the week with, or in the next few days with my other guests also, but it doesn't seem as if Ryan has told his family anything. So it's something that just burdened on him internally, even though mm-hmm. he doesn't express it to anybody, not even his wife, because his wife, you know, we'll look at the gravestone and go, who the hell is John Miller? You know, that's more or less what she says. You know, mm-hmm. so.
No.
You know, it's an internal fight that Ryan will have, you know, for the next 50 years.
Right. Just because I said it echoes for him for the rest of his life, I didn't mean in terms of out loud. It's something that has driven him in everything he's been worried about, decision-wise, life-wise. I mean, it's a heavy burden with those two words.
That's very true.
But you know what? I will say this. Yeah. To not get too maudlin, and I just, you know, I did my daily show yesterday, and I wanted to do something a little bit more uplifting toward the end because a lot of people walk around with so much anxiety and depression and everything, and sometimes we just forget to appreciate the little things, the small things, and we wire ourselves to be so fixated on everything wrong or everything or things that we don't think we've done well enough or things we didn't push, you know. Why are we behind other people? Why did we not accomplish more? What did I do today? What should I have said differently? We get so wound up in the things we've done wrong, we forget about all the good little things, even if they're small. And this idea of earning this, are you doing that every day as an audience? You go when you leave the movie, what are you doing to make sure you're leading as good a life as you can? Are you going to be stuck always worrying about whether or not you're keeping up with somebody? Are you going to be constantly worried or depressed because of all the things you wish you had done differently? Or are you going to go look forward to each new day as, hey, it's a new day to try to show that I can do something with my life? And so I kind of want to also think of it as a positive. It's a message for all of us. What are you doing to kind of earn what you do day in and day out?
That makes a lot of sense. Do you think that was part of Spielberg's point with this?
Well, I don't know if it's, I mean, if it was written in the script, I mean, the script writer's going to have it, but from my perspective, I mean, I feel like we're right here. We're right in the scene. We established at the beginning of this minute, the camera's right there. He might as well be talking to us. Look at everything that World War II generation did to liberate the world. What are we doing to earn their sacrifice? What are we doing that we didn't have to be in their position?
Right.
So sure. I just, to put a little more positive, I think everybody, we could all take a moment and go, you know what? As much as I think I've got problems, I've also got a lot of good. And if I would just stop every now and then and remember I've got good things going on, you wouldn't feel so blue all the time.
True. Very cool. All right. So did you have anything else you want to say about this minute, Alan?
No. That's, I think we I'm just – this is just to recap for people if they didn't remember when I said it before. This is my second favorite World War II movie of all time. And it is – it's still in that, and only because Patton made such an impression on me as a kid, it still – edges this one out, but this one is such an amazing movie and is worth a yearly watch.
Yeah, at least. All right, so Alan, you want to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, I do a news talk format show, and so if you're into the news of the day, obviously I live here in the United States, so it's a lot more focused on presidential, U.S. presidential politics and national politics here. It's called The Alan Sanders Show. It's 5 days a week, and you can find me wherever you find great podcasts. Just search for The Alan Sanders Show.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So I will be back again tomorrow. Remember, everyone, we're doing the weekends, so I will be back again tomorrow on the Sunday episode, and Alan will be joining me once again.
Now, have you teased the audience as to why you had to kind of put some of these episodes on weekends?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure. Just to remind everyone, so we're going to have another show again tomorrow because the whole idea is to finish this all on June 6th on D-Day 2025.
Yeah.
So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.